Psalm chapter 39. Now chapter 39, verses 1 through 16, which brings us to the end of this prophecy. What Ezekiel does in chapter 39, verses 1 through 6, is to provide a few more details of what he just said in chapter 38. Verse specifies where the invading army will be destroyed, where in Israel the invading army will be destroyed. So again, addresses Gog and the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, and then look at verse 2. I will turn you about and will lead you on and will cause you to come up from the outermost parts of the north. I'll bring you upon the mountains of Israel. And then in verse 4, and you shall fall upon the mountains of Israel. The mountains of Israel refer to the central mountain range that make up the backbone of the country. It begins at the south end of the Jezreel Valley, at the south end of the Galilee, runs the whole length of the country, peering out just north of Beersheba. In these mountains, you have many of the more famous cities of Scripture, like, for example, Shechem and Shiloh. You have the Ramah. You have Ai, you have Jerusalem, you have Bethlehem, you have Hebron, and many other cities. And what that shows is that the armies that invade will penetrate Israeli defenses, and they'll enter into the central mountain range. And it is only then that God will begin to do the work of intervention and will do the many different things he listed in chapter 38, verses 17 through 22, resulting in a total annihilation of the whole invading army. Now, King James reads, for some reason, I will leave but a sixth part of you. That's not in the Hebrew text. And it's not; there won't be one sixth left. It will result in a total annihilation of the whole invading army. And so by the time the destruction occurs, no one is left whatsoever. And, and then verse 6, I will send a fire on Magog and on them that dwell securely in the isles, and they shall know that I am Jehovah. And what he points out in this verse is that not only will the Magog army and its alliances be totally wiped out upon the mountains of Israel, God also rained fire and brimstone upon the land of Magog. Again, Magog today would be just the southern part of Russia between the Black and Caspian Seas. And so the land which organized all these armies also suffers a rather massive destruction. And then concluding the prophecy, in verses 9 and 10, he points out, because of so much equipment being destroyed, it's going to take about 7 years of burning to get rid of all of the equipment. A lot of this becomes a source of power for Israel for this 7-year period. But then in verses 11 through 16, it's going to take 7 months to get all of the dead buried. And the land is defiled or unclean until everybody is finally buried. And because they fall in the mountains of Israel, many bodies fall into various crevices or valleys or ravines in the mountains, so the bodies will not always be visible. And so they will employ people for several months to search out where the bodies are, and then raise some kind of a marker where the body is, so those in charge of actually burying the dead body will find these bodies that way and get them buried. And it will take 7 months till the last body is buried. And furthermore, in verse 16, we'll go back to verse 15. And they that pass through the land shall pass through, and when they see a man's bones, then shall he sit up and sign by it till the burials have buried it in the valley of Hamon Gog. And Hamona, or Hamonah, shall also be the name of a city. Thus shall they cleanse the land. So a new city will be built on a on the top of one of the mountains of the mountains of Israel, looking down on this valley where all of the enemy dead have been gathered together for burial. And they'd be looking down on this burial place as a reminder of what God has done. Verse 17 is not part of the prophecy. It's actually a new prophecy, and so you don't know, God does not appear again, and so on. But now the question is, let me see if that's on page 2. You go to page 2, the timing of this invasion. I've given you a couple of rabbinic quotes a little while ago. Here's a couple of more that the rabbis also saw this prophecy somehow connected with what became Russia. And here is one quotation from an Orthodox source. The Gaonim, which is the leading rabbis following the close of the Talmudic period, the Gaonim had a tradition that these controls were indeed located in Russia. One tradition passed down from the Vilna Gaon states, when the Russian Navy passes through the Bosporus on the way to the Dardanelles, it'll be time to put on Shabbat Sabbath clothing in anticipation of the coming of the Messiah. Another one from the Midrashim of rabbinic writings of ancient times, the Midrash calls Gomer Germania, and that's also the way the Talmud refers to Gomer, and Germania is the Hebrew word for Germany. Now, the Orthodox Jewish commentary on Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 2 reads as follows. Quoting one of the Yerushalayim Megillah, an ancient document, which renders Magog as Gutia, or Gutia, referring to the Goths, a group of nomadic tribes who destroyed the Scythians and made their home in Scythian territory. Considering that the Goths were a Germanic people, the identification of Magog's descendants as the Goths accords well in the Targum Jonathan to Genesis 10:2, which renders Magog as Germa Mima, which is in Bereshit Rabbah given as Germania, again Germany. So these we're not just dealing with Christian interpretations, we're dealing with something that was already a Jewish interpretation much before this passage became that interesting for the Christian community. Now, everything we've said so far would be the basic exegesis of the passage, but now we have to face the question, what is the timing of this invasion? Now, within our own circles that take the Bible quite literally, unless the text says otherwise, that there are different views. So, for example, under small a basic observation, the observations we've made so far is that it is an invasion that takes place only after there's been a worldwide regathering of Israel in unbelief, and they've been rebuilding the cities that lie waste, and they've been able to slowly raise their economic status in the world and things of that nature. And the thing that people have to deal with is how do you fit in the 7 months of burial and, more significantly, the 7 years of burning? And some of these views I'm going to make reference to on your outline, they do not actually spend much time on dealing with these differences or on those problems, the 7 months and 7 years. So one common view is the mid-tribulation view, that this invasion takes place at the middle of the tribulation. Now, this has no problem with the 7 months of burial. However, it has a problem with the 7 years of burning, because it will mean burning the equipment after 3.5 years in the second half of the tribulation, and also burning the equipment for 3.5 more years into the Messianic kingdom. The reason this doesn't work is because as you look at Isaiah chapter 65, verses 17 to 25, Isaiah 65, verses 17 to 25, he describes how God will supernaturally renovate the earth. to make it habitable for the Messianic kingdom, because in the tribulation judgments as outlined in Revelation chapter 6, 8, 9, and 16, Revelation 6, 8, 9, and 16, by the time the tribulation judgments have run the course, about three quarters of the earth's surface is totally destroyed. And therefore, to make the earth habitable again, there's to be a supernatural renovation. And that would not include getting all of these weapons continuing to the Messianic kingdom, because once the Messianic kingdom begins, all weapons of war are removed. So the mid-tribulation does not quite fit the 7 years, though it is not a problem for the 7 months of burial. Another view is the post-tribulation view, making this same as Armageddon. And here again, the difference between those two events is that Armageddon clearly teaches more than once, like Zechariah chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, Zechariah 14, verses 1 and 2, all the armies of all the nations come against Jerusalem and the Jewish people. As we saw in our discussion in this passage, there are other groups of nations that oppose the invasion. They're not content with it. They're not happy with it. And so what Armageddon describes and what this invasion describes cannot be the same thing. But the biggest problem, what do you do with the 7 months and 7 years? Because they would mean 7 months of burial that would take us right into the kingdom, and 7 years of burning for the first 7 years of the kingdom. And again, in light of how Isaiah describes the miraculous renovation in chapter 65, verses 17 to 25, it simply will not fit. Another view is the interlude view, that there'll be an interlude period between the end of tribulation and the start of the Messianic kingdom. Now, it's true that there will be an interlude period, and we know that from Daniel chapter 12, verses 11 through 13, Daniel 12, 11 through 13, and in that interlude, they believe this invasion will occur. But in Daniel, the interlude is only 75 days long, and 7 months of burial is 210 days long. You still end up on a greater number of days of trying to bury bodies into the Messianic kingdom, again, not fitting very well with the supernatural renovation. And furthermore, you'll be burning weaponry for the first 7 years into the kingdom. Again, that doesn't fit well with Isaiah 65 prophecy. Another view is this, the post-millennial view, making this invasion the same as the Gog and Magog invasion mentioned in Revelation 20, verses 7 through 10. Revelation 20, verses 7 through 10. Now, if you look at the context of that passage, as the invasion enters the land of Israel, God will quickly dispense with it with fire from heaven. And at that point, the earth, the universe, the earth that we have known since Genesis chapter 1, will simply cease to exist. And God will create new heavens and the new earth. Now, this creates a problem for both the 7 months of burial and the 7 years of burning, because it would mean you would have to bury bodies for 7 months into the eternal state, which means you would have to transfer all the bodies from the old earth and transfer them into the new earth in order to be able to fit them into this period of time. And furthermore, we also learn from chapter 20, verses 11 through 15, that once the enemy is destroyed and the universe is done away with, God will, there will come the great white throne judgment. And for the great white throne judgment, he will be resurrecting all unbelievers. It would seem to be a useless energy and waste of time to have to bury for 5 months all these people if God's going to resurrect them back to life anyway for the great white throne judgment. So putting it at the end of the end of the kingdom doesn't fit the 7 months of burial, and less so the 7 years of burning. The reason it uses the term Gog and Magog is because in light of the Ezekiel prophecy, the term Gog and Magog later becomes an idiom for any invasion of Israel. Like the expression, he crossed the Rubicon, because when Caesar crossed the river, the Tiber River, that was his undoing of the Roman government and the inauguration of the Caesarian government, which was an absolute monarchy. And that became idiomatic. Also, he met his Waterloo. That's where Napoleon was defeated by the Alliance armies, and has someone rising in authority, rising in power, rising in success, but then has a sudden collapse. We say he met his Waterloo. It's an idiom based upon historical event. The term Gog and Magog in Revelation 20 becomes idiomatic, because in Ezekiel only a set number of nations invade. But as you read Revelation 20, it's worldwide, with nobody protesting it. So it doesn't fit very well with the post-millennial view either. I would say it will have to happen sometime before the tribulation, not necessarily before the rapture, before the tribulation. It has to happen at least 3.5 years before the tribulation. And why 3.5 years before? It could happen many more years than that. But the 7 years of burning has to end by the midpoint of the tribulation. Because at that point, as we read from key passages like Matthew 24, verses 15 to 28, Matthew 24, 15 to 28, Revelation chapter 12, verse 6 to 17, Revelation 12, verse 6 to 17, that is when the Israel has to flee the land. It's the point of time the Antichrist takes over the Jewish temple, proclaims themselves to be God Almighty, and the abomination of desolation now signals Satan's final attempt to try to annihilate the Jews to avoid the second coming. Again, the abomination of desolation signals Satan's final attempt to annihilate the Jews worldwide. He'll focus on setting up a Nazi-type system worldwide this time to annihilate every Jew to avoid Israel coming to faith and therefore avoid the second coming. And because that is his goal, the Jews have to flee the land, and they flee at the time of the abomination, and that happens at the midpoint of the tribulation. And so the 7 years of burning have to end at the midpoint. Now again, it could happen 20 years before the tribulation starts, but no later than 3.5 years before the tribulation starts. And that presents no problem for the 7 months of burial and the 7 years of burning. And so for these reasons, I would take this prophecy to happen sometime before the tribulation. Some people assume when I say this, that means it has to happen before the rapture. No, rapture and this invasion are both pre-trib. We don't know which one will come first. For example, we knew from Bible prophecy Israel has to become a state before the tribulation. But the rapture could have come even before Israel became a state. So before 1948, we did not know, will the rapture come first or Israel become first? It turned out Israel came first. By the same token, the Gog and Magog invasion and the tribulation and the rapture both occur before the tribulation. We do not know which one will come first, because the rapture could come today. And so saying that this invasion comes before the tribulation is not the same as saying it comes before the rapture. Maybe yes, maybe no, we don't know. Okay, let's move on now to some of the other events, and let's go to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7, along with Daniel chapter 2, provides the survey of what we call the times of the Gentiles, when Gentiles hold domination over Jerusalem and the Jewish people. And in this survey, he points out there'll be four Gentile empires. First of all, Babylonia. Secondly, Medo-Persia. Thirdly, the Hellenistic Empire. Then there goes two different stages. The first stage is a united stage under Alexander the Great, and then a four division stage when the empire is divided by four of his generals after Alexander dies an untimely death. Then will come the Roman Empire, or the fourth Gentile Empire, that undergoes five specific stages. I'm simply going to list them briefly because now it's took their germane to this study. The first stage is the Roman Empire stage, the United Roman Empire. The second stage is the two division stage, which happens when the Roman Empire is divided between the Eastern Roman Empire and the Western Roman Empire. Thirdly, there'll be a one world government stage. Fourthly, there'll be a 10 division stage. And then finally, the Antichrist stage. So look at chapter 7, verse 23, where we pick up with the third and fourth and move into the fifth stage. Then he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all the kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. So he points out there'll eventually be a third division of the fifth of the four Gentile empire, which will be some kind of a one world government stage of some kind. We don't give a lot of details. But clearly says it will devour the whole earth. Same terminology as used of Noah's Ark. Devoured, covered the whole earth. So this cannot be limited to Western Europe or the European common community, common market. This will eventually devour the whole earth, both East and West. And it will rise before the tribulation starts and will demise before the tribulation starts. How long it will last, or whether there will be a united government of some kind or an autocracy of some kind, we don't have those details in Scripture. But he says in verse 24, as for the 10 horns out of this kingdom, now which kingdom? The previous verse, the same kingdom devours the whole earth. Out of this kingdom shall 10 kings arise. And so we'll see that there's going to be a division into 10 kingdoms. And these 10 kingdoms will be both East and West. We now have about 200 nations around the world today. But in the future, there'll be a restructuring of the world borders so that there'll be 10 Gentile nations plus Israel. And 10 kings will rule the world simultaneously. And this will begin sometime before the tribulation starts and continue into the middle of the tribulation. The 10 kingdom division. Now, to give an illustration, there's a group called the Club of Rome, which are many of the Nobel Prize winners and so on. A number of years ago, they made a suggestion about the ways of conserving the world energies. And they divided, and what the interesting is, they divided the world into 10 different divisions. I'm not saying this is where it's going to be. There's going to be a 10 division states, whether it follows the Club of Rome or not, there's no way to know. Be more like North America being one country, South America being a second, Europe being a third, Asia fourth and fifth, and things of that nature. So they'll be reduced to 10 Gentile nations plus Israel. And so the 10 kingdoms, the federal government stage is the fifth birth pang, and now the 10 division stage will be the sixth birth pang. And that will lead to the seventh birth pang, the rise of the Antichrist. And reading verse 24, as for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom shall 10 kings arise, and another shall arise after them. And he shall be diverse from the former. He shall put down 3 kings. Now he will begin to rise to power before the tribulation starts. He will not gain world authority until the middle of the tribulation. But rise to world power at the same time that the 10 kings are existing. And he'll gain full power only in the middle of the tribulation when he kills 3 kings. The other 7 submit to him. That goes beyond our scope in the study. He'll begin to rise to power around the world during the 10 kingdom division. And he'll be, and that's when he'll be able to begin rising to more and more power, though he won't gain full power till the midpoint. So the 10 kingdom division again begins before the tribulation, continues until the middle, but also before the tribulation, the Antichrist will begin to rise to power. Now for the 8th birth pang, let's go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thess chapter 5. In chapter 4, verses 13 through 18, he describes the rapture event. But he says in chapter 5, verse 1, but concerning. The Greek, two Greek words here, peri, P-E-R-I, P-E-R-I, and the word de, D-E, de, D-E. And peri de, in most cases, introduces a brand new topic. As you read through the book of 1 Corinthians, he uses this peri-der construction frequently because every time he introduces a new topic, he says, but concerning this, but concerning that. In Greek, it's always peri-der, peri-der. So what this shows is that while he's been discussing the rapture in chapter 4, verses 13 through 18, he now says in verse 1, but concerning, Greek peri-der, is about to introduce a new topic. New topic is in verse 2. He yourselves know perfectly the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. Now his new topic is the day of the Lord, which as we said earlier in our study, is the most common term for what we now call the tribulation. So the most common term today is tribulation, great tribulation. The most common term in both testaments is the day of Jehovah and the day of the Lord. Now in verse 3, when they are saying peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as travail upon a woman with child, again that birth pang motif, and shall in no wise escape. She points out that before the day of the Lord actually arrives, there'll be a period of peace and false security. The thing world peace has finally arrived. There'll be a period of peace and false security. But this peace and false security will then be shattered by a key event, which brings us to the 9th birth pang, the 7-year covenant. Let's go to Daniel chapter 9. In Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 27, the prophet gives us his famous prophecy of the 77ths, a period of 490-year period that God has decreed upon the Jewish people. And notice carefully, the focus of the 77s is upon your people, Daniel's people, the Jewish people, and upon your holy city, Daniel's holy city, Jerusalem. It must be carefully seen that the outworking of this 490th period is relevant only for Israel, not the Gentiles or the church, but specifically to Israel. And now for our purpose, skip down to verse 27. And he shall make a firm covenant with many for 17. And here we learn that the last 7 years of this 490-year period, the first 483 years, the first 483 years of this period, has already been fulfilled at the time of the first coming. But now there's still 7 years left to run. And what will signal the last 7 years is what he says in verse 27. Someone will make a firm covenant with many for 17. The pronoun he goes back to its narrowest antecedent, which is in verse 26, says, the prince that shall come. The prince that shall come. In other words, the prince that shall come in verse 26, and the he who makes a covenant in verse 27 is the one and the same individual. Better known in our circles as simply the Antichrist. And so the 7 year period, the last 7 years, the 7 years of tribulation, begin with the signing of a 7 year covenant between Israel and the Antichrist. It will not be the rapture itself that triggers the tribulation. The rapture comes sometime before the tribulation starts, but we do not win before. But the event that triggers the 7 years is the signing of the 7 year covenant. Until this covenant is signed, the tribulation simply cannot begin. This presupposes two things will be in place. One is and one is not. One thing that has to be in place is that the Antichrist will already be in high political authority with whom a sovereign state like Israel can sign a covenant of this nature. And this is not yet in place. But the second thing this presupposes that there is a Jewish state or a Jewish government with whom a covenant of this could be signed, and that has been true only as of 1948. So the tribulation could not have come before 1948. There's no Jewish state or Jewish government with whom a covenant of this could be signed. But this passage requires a Jewish government to exist, and now we have such a government. And during the sixth birth pang, when the rise of the Antichrist comes to more and more power, followed by a peace and false security, at that point, he will begin to sign a covenant. And the covenant is going to be intended to last for 7 years, though it will not last as long as it was intended to. Now notice three things in this passage. Number one, the covenant is made with many, but not with all. The many would have to be the leadership of Israel that's empowered to make such a covenant, but will not be made with all. There'll be a segment of the Jewish population that reject having anything to do with this covenant. Secondly, though it's intended to last for 7 years, it won't last that long because in the middle of the seven, he says, he shall cause the sacrifice, the oblation to cease. At the halfway point, when he takes over the temple, there'll be a forced cessation of the sacrificial system in what is going to be the third temple. And this will mark the breaking of the covenant. And then thirdly, the result of the breaking of the covenant. Upon the wing of abomination shall come one who makes desolate, even the full end that thou determined shall wrath be put out upon the desolate. And now a period of wrath falls upon the Jewish people, as Satan inaugurates to the Antichrist, the worldwide attempt to annihilate the Jews once and for all. The covenant as viewed in verse 27 is viewed from a human perspective, from a human viewpoint, it will simply be an attempt to make a covenant that didn't last as long as it was intended to. Let's look at one more passage on this study, which is Isaiah 28, that gives us God's perspective on the same covenant. Isaiah chapter 28. The passage begins giving us God's perspective on the many who make the covenant. At verse 14, "Wherefore hear the word of Jehovah, ye scoffers, that rule this people that is in Jerusalem." And God's point is to call them scoffers, to call them mockers, to call them fools. And that's because of his perspective on the covenant in verse 15. "Because ye have said, we made a covenant with death, at which ye all are in agreement. And when the overflowing scourge shall pass through, it shall not come unto us. For it made lies our refuge, and unto falsehood have we hid ourselves." It's in this verse that we realize or learn why Israel bothers to make such a covenant. Now, in the Ezekiel passage, people sometimes claim that that invasion happened, Israel was living in peace. The word for peace is shalom. It's not used even once in the Ezekiel 38:39 passage. The word that is used is security, but not peace. It doesn't mean Israel will live in peace, but in a state of security, which means in self-confidence. The word is used elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible, even in the context of war. And the point is that Israel will be self-assured. Israel living in security when the invasion of Ezekiel 38 takes place. By the time of this invasion, of this covenant, Israel loses its sense of self-security. And often it's referred to as a peace covenant. Again, doesn't say a peace covenant. It is merely a matter, a covenant of military security. And the Israeli leadership will come to feel that the only hope they have of attaining that long-sought-for security is by making this covenant with the Antichrist. But God says, "You're fools for thinking so. This is not a covenant of heaven, but of hell. Not a covenant of life, but of death." Now, in previous conferences, I've emphasized that the Bible uses many symbols, but there's consistency in usage of biblical symbols. Any one symbol means the same thing through both testaments, about 95% of the cases. There's a 5th percentile where a symbol can be used more than one way. 95% is always the same way. And previous examples we looked at in other conferences, when the word stone is used symbolically, it symbolizes the Messiah. When the word mountain is used symbolically, it symbolizes a king or kingdom or throne. When the word star is used symbolically, it symbolizes an angel. And the word cloud is just symbolically, it symbolizes God's glory, the Shekinah glory. And when the figure of a flood, which is what's being used here, when the figure of a flood is used symbolically, it's always a symbol of military invasion. And so the goal of signing this covenant is finally to feel they'll be exempt from any further military problems. And God says, "You're putting your faith in the wrong person. I'm the one you put your faith in, not this man." Then in verse 16, we read of the non-many who would not go along with the covenant. And as those notice that put their faith in the stone. "Therefore thus says the Lord Jehovah, behold, I lay in Zion for foundation a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believes shall not be in haste." And this refers to that future Messianic Jewish community, especially living in Israel, that they will not go along with that covenant. Why? Because they put their faith in the stone, and when the word stone is used symbolically, it's a symbol of the Messiah. And so the Messianic community in that day, whatever, however small or large they may be, would be the ones among the non-many that refuse to go along with the covenant. And what happened in Daniel 9:27 happens here. Verse 18, "Your covenant with death shall be annulled, your agreement with Sheol shall not stand, A wind of a flowing skirt shall pass through, then you shall be trodden down by it. They made the covenant for reasons of comfort and security, but once the covenant is broken and annulled, they have a strong measure of insecurity and discomfort. And the picture of this extreme discomfiture is given in verse 19. As often as it passes through, it shall take you from morning by morning. It shall pass through by day and by night. There shall be nothing but terror to understand the message. For the bed is shorter than man can stretch himself out on it, and the cover narrow, can he wrap himself up in it? The picture of extreme discomfiture is now given two illustrations. First of all, like trying to stretch yourself out on a bed, but this bed is simply too short for you. You cannot sleep comfortably. Now, being a 5'4" Jewish kid, I've never had this first experience. Every bed that tried to stretch myself out on it, I've succeeded admirably. There's some problems you don't have when you're 5'4". I used to lead these 5-week study tours of Israel every year, and a group I led back in 1978, one of the attendants or participants was a professional basketball player with the San Antonio Spurs. He's the only Philistine ever came on my trip like this. And because beds are made for white-sized people, he will often complain to me about a very uncomfortable night because he couldn't stretch himself out on it. He had to take the pillow and sheets on the floor and sleep on the floor. I had no way of identifying myself with his trials and tribulations. Some problems you don't have when you're my height. I have had the second experience. I was a student at the Hebrew University. This was January 1967. And those of us majoring in historical geography of the land and minoring in archaeology were given a couple of weeks from classes to do some practical work. So sent down to the Negev Desert. This was about 5 or 6 months before the Six-Day War. And so the area we were working was very close to the old border with Jordan. For reasons of security, we had to spend each night at a military encampment. And the blanket I was issued at the military camp the first night was even too small for a 5'4" Jewish kid. That night, as I tried to keep my nose warm, my feet would get cold. I tried to warm up my feet and my nose got cold. And all night long, I had the same experience, falling asleep, waking up, because that stupid blanket wouldn't cover all of me. It was not of insecurity, and that of discomfort, which is the point of verse 20. Now look at verse 21. For Jehovah rises up as in Mount Perazim, he brought us the valley of Gibeon, that he may do his work, his strange work, and bring to pass his act, his strange act. Now therefore be not scoffers, lest your bonds be made strong, for a decree of destruction have I heard from the Lord, Jehovah of hosts, upon the whole earth. The Bible gives us many different names, but now simply called the tribulation. There are two such names, Jehovah's strange work and Jehovah's strange act. It's both his strange work and his strange act because of the closing phrase of verse 22. God now issues a decree of destruction against the whole earth. And this decree of destruction is the same as the seven sealed scroll of Revelation chapters 5 and 6. And as each seal is broken, there is a massive destruction of the earth's surface and a massive destruction of the earth's population. So by the time the 7 years have run their course, somewhere between 2/3 up to 3/4 of the earth's surface is destroyed, equal percentage of the earth's population. But God issues this decree of destruction only as a result of the signing of the 7-year covenant. And that's what will trigger the tribulation. These are the 9 events we can put into summary format. Let's talk about 2 of the 3 things below that. We already talked about the third temple from reading those 4 passages of scripture. Well, and so it points out there will be a temple rebuilt no later than the midpoint of the tribulation. Now 2 other events. Let's go to Joel chapter 2. Second minor prophet. Joel chapter 2. Now, what I mean by blackout is the period of time that there is no light coming to the earth from the sun, moon, and stars. And in the prophecies of the last days, there'll be five different blackouts. Three of these, numbers 2, 3, and 4, happen during the tribulation, and the fifth one happens right after the tribulation. But here we're going to read a one that happens sometime before the tribulation. And verse 31 reads as follows. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of Jehovah comes. So before the day of Jehovah arrives, there'll be a blacking out of the sun, and for a period of time there'll be no light coming from the sun or the moon. And this will happen sometime before the day of the Lord. We don't have enough information to know when, so we cannot yet put it in the chronological sequence. Will happen sometime before the tribulation starts. And now let's go to the return of Elijah, and let's go to Malachi chapter 4. Malachi chapter 4. And look at verse 5, Malachi 4, verse 5. Behold, I send you Elijah the prophet before the great and terrible day of Jehovah come. And Elijah was not promised to come before the first coming. There was a forerunner promise before the first coming in chapter 3, verse 1. And chapter 3, verse 1 was fulfilled by John the Baptist. But here's dealing with the return of Elijah the prophet. But the promise will come not before the first coming, but before the second coming, and be more specific, sometime before the tribulation starts. And the purpose of his return is in verse 6. He shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Now the Jewish family unit has a reputation, and well deserved, for being a strong, tight unit. But what will divide it, and what Jesus said will divide it in Luke chapter 7, in Luke 7, is that because of the rejection, he'll become a point of division and not unification to the Jewish family unit. Father against son, mother against daughter, and things of that nature. And as soon as any member of a Jewish family becomes a believer, there is instantaneous division. But the purpose of Elijah is to come to overcome that stumbling block about Yeshua, about Jesus, to overcome that stumbling block, and for them to finally recognize who they must believe in to bring about the return of the Messiah. And so the goal of Elijah is to prepare Israel for the reception of the acceptance of the Messiah, which will in turn bring about the second coming and kingdom. But the return of Elijah will begin sometime before the tribulation starts, but here again, we don't have enough information in this context to know when before. Only at the event, which we cannot discuss because it's going to take a lot more time, it's not part of this study specifically, is the rapture of the church. We've taught on that in the past, I believe, and that will be another event. And as far as timing, it can happen anytime between right now and the signing of the covenant. Anytime between right this minute and the signing of the covenant. We may see some more prophetic events. We may see no more prophetic events, because the rapture could come even today. 1:15. My time ran out.